You are listening to Press Pass, brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of Press Pass on GNAT TV. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Friday, September 17th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our virtual studio by an old friend and a hometown boy who made good, I guess you could say, Kyle Madura, who is now the Washington correspondent with Gray Television, is with us to share some of the tales of his work down in the Washington, D.C. area. Many of you will remember that Kyle was also a reporter with WCAX in Burlington and covered Montpelier in the State House for many years. He's been down in Washington since September of 2017, so it'll be great to kind of catch up and hear what's been going on. Many of you will remember that Kyle was also a member of the 2005 Burn Burton Division II baseball team, a championship baseball team. He was a graduate from Burn Burton in 2005, a member of that school's Athletic Hall of Fame, and went on from there to Northwestern University, where he studied journalism, and went on from there to work at a television station in Montana before arriving at WCAX. Kyle, great to have you back. Good to see you again, and I can't wait to hear about some of your adventures down in the Washington, D.C. area. I was thinking, just to kind of get us started here, tell us a little bit about what you're covering these days. What is your beat, what are some of the stories you're on the lookout for?
So my primary beat runs from Maine all the way to Kentucky. So I like to say that the political spectrum I cover ranges from Senator Bernie Sanders back in Vermont to Senator Rand Paul, and it's got Senators Manchin and Collins, respectively a Democrat and Republican, smack dab in the middle. So I get a little bit of flavor of everything and a whole lot of the country. Lately, we've been working on several different issues, primarily this week. In the next couple of weeks, we're trying to unpack a little bit of the budget bill. That's going to be a $3.5 trillion package. If leading Democratic voices have their way, that could all obviously collapse under its own weight as well. So rather than looking at the big picture and the palace intrigue, so to speak, we really like to dive into the details as they come out of committee. So I spoke with Representative Welch earlier this week for a piece we're going to hopefully put on air next week, looking at some of the energy elements, some of the broadband elements. I'll likely be connecting with some of the lawmakers I cover who are on the Agriculture Committee, diving into what that might mean for dairy, other associated elements of agriculture. What I do in D.C. is actually very similar to what I did at CAX if I were to be sent to the Capitol to cover Vermont issues. I'm supposed to be the local guy for WCAX still in a number of other stations. And we go down there and we focus on, I'm here permanently, but we focus on the issues that truly matter back home. So it's not a lot of foreign policy. It's a lot more of infrastructure coverage, budget coverage when it comes to taxes, broadband, the issues that matter in day-to-day lives, and that will have traction back wherever our viewers are that day.
Well, that must be fascinating, going into the nation's capital and the Capitol and talking to lawmakers at that level. What can you tell us about the state of the infrastructure bill, just to kind of, before we move along here? That's been in the news an awful lot, very controversial piece of legislation, a lot of money, and it sounds like Joe Manchin holds all the cards on this one.
And when it comes to infrastructure, I'm going to use that favorite journalistic metaphor and say it's currently stuck in gridlock. It's past the Senate at this point. It's in the House. Depending on how things sugar off with the budget conversations, this thing is good to go. But progressives are saying they don't want to move forward with the infrastructure package in the House until they see what comes out of the budget. They weren't thrilled with what was left off the table in the infrastructure package. They wanted a lot more. But in order to get that bipartisan win, they said, okay, we'll pare it down to what we can get support for from Republicans in the Senate, and ended up with 69 votes, if memory serves. So 19 Republicans on board. But it's all going to hinge on what happens with the budget, at least based on the lines in the sand that they're currently drawing between the progressives and the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. And so when it comes to that element, there's a lot of wait and see with the budget reconciliation package. As folks back home are aware, Senator Bernie Sanders really was the driving force behind this $3.5 trillion project that includes, frankly, most of the Biden social agenda. So everything from a couple of years of free college to pre-K getting covered to greening the electric system, making sure that we do more to combat climate change. Obviously, the Republicans aren't necessarily as big a fans of that package, especially when it comes to the spending side of things. The majority in the House for the Democrats is extremely narrow. So there's a group there that are putting their leverage to the test, seeing how much they can pull out of it. Senator Sanders and progressive House leaders have said, we see $3.5 trillion as a floor. Moderates like Senator Manchin have said that, you know, $1.5 trillion, I think he told me $2 trillion back in May, and now it's $1.5 trillion, maybe even $1 trillion. So we'll see if those are lines in the sand or lines in cement, but if they can't work something out in the middle, both the infrastructure package and this budget bill could collapse under its own political weight.
So is there a clock here going on? Is there a point where this really kind of some action will have to be taken or?
There's one in name only right now. September 27th is looming large. It's a big date. That's a kind of a compromise date that Speaker Pelosi and one of those moderate reps, Representative Jared Golden from Maine and some others, agreed to as a vote certain date on the infrastructure package. That was meant to move things along and get them on board with proceeding with some of this budget talk. If that date comes and there's not a budget deal yet, which is uncertain, but it's certainly not looking like a sure thing, she could potentially move that back. There's room to fiddle along the edges. And then the other element that comes into this is we've got a debt ceiling debate ongoing yet again in Washington. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he doesn't want to tackle that on its own. He wants the Democrats to push it through with reconciliation on the budget process. So again, we'll have to see if he sticks to that hard line. A lot of negotiating positions in play. It seems like it could be politically dramatic and unfortunate for members of all stripes if all of this comes to pass. I mean, defaulting on the debt would mean big problems for the federal government.
No kidding. Particularly at a time when the economy is sort of rebounding, but doing exactly what certainly I'm sure President Biden would like to see happening, particularly when it comes to the employment situation, where it seems like up here at any way, and I'm sure it's the case probably down your way as well, most businesses seem to be having a very hard time attracting qualified workers or workers, period, to come that they could train. So, one other story I saw that you did recently, which kind of intrigued me before we move on, is the Virginia governor's race. I see you had a story about that. That's kind of interesting. It kind of, in the wake of the recall vote out in California for Gavin Newsom, I guess the governor's race in Virginia is kind of the next big test, if you will, of where both parties may be going in terms of crafting messages when we get to 2022 and the congressional elections that year. What's the story down there? A former governor is running and apparently seems to be doing well. I guess in Virginia, they're term limited to one term and can't run for re-election.
Yeah, I'd be cautious bridging into this because I tend to go all historical, political nerd on this sort of thing. But basically, when Virginia passed that law of a governor gets one term, then they're term limited and they can come back, but non-consecutively. When they passed that law, it was actually one of the most progressive in the nation. Obviously, that wouldn't be viewed under quite the same lens these days. But you've got Governor Terry McAuliffe, who led Virginia previously. He's been a Democratic fundraiser for years, very well connected in Washington. He's up against Glenn Youngkin, who operated in the finance world and has quite the personal wealth fortune behind him. He's been tapping into that. Washington and national politics has a way of getting caught up in these off-year governor's races. And Virginia tends to find itself at the center of that, not only because of its geographic proximity, But because it is a 2021 race ahead of the 2022 midterm. So everyone sees it as an indicator. Whether it may or may not be, I'll leave to smarter statistical minds, but I know it's a trap we as journalists fall into. So it's really interesting in watching that dynamic play out, because you have someone in McAuliffe who's well tied to the Democratic establishment. Virginia's been a state that, you know, was red, it's been purple for quite some time. If anything, it's even a little bit blue now. So he's not shying away from the Democratic talking points. He's leaning into them, both at the national level and at the state level. When it comes to Youngkin, he's in a delicate dance, really, because in Virginia, you've got Northern Virginia and its politics, and you've got the rest of Virginia and its politics, and they tend to be very different, much in the same way that the Burlington bubble in Vermont might be very different from the rest of the state. So Youngkin is, during his primary, he went out of his way to make sure he at least somewhat embraced the policies of President Trump. Since pivoting to the general, he's been far more wishy-washy on those sorts of things. He's really been trying as much as possible to focus on those state elements and argue that he'll be better for the economy, argue that he'll be better on police, but then simultaneously we'll pivot right into a discussion of critical race theory or of defund the police. So you see both candidates really talking about Virginia, but it also, their rhetoric broadens out to encompass those national politics.
Mm. Oh, it must be fascinating. Well, I was just curious, you know, this sounds like there's a lot of difference between what you're doing now and covering the state house in Montpelier, but as you think back to the, I think it was what, about 6 or 7 years you spent covering Montpelier, kind of what stands out as you think back and reflect on those days and following the folks around under the Golden Dome up there?
Well, I can tell you for certain that personally, I very much miss covering a citizen legislature. You'd go into committee meetings at the Vermont State House, and they were an opportunity for everyone to learn and ask the same questions of experts or real people, whatever the case may be, whatever topic they were exploring. Everyone was there to try to figure out whether they agreed ultimately on the direction the state should go. Everyone there was trying to figure out what the facts were, what the lay of the land was. Whereas, you know, in DC, if you go to a committee meeting, a lot of the opening statements are entirely prescripted. Obviously that was the case to a degree in Vermont, but then a lot of the questions are meant for political purposes, to have that moment they can snapshot on C-SPAN and put on TV or to make their political point. They've done their research. They have their own set of facts that they're going to subscribe to. It's not quite the same collegial interrogation, so that everybody can get the same information. Some of them are there more to get that moment on TV for political purposes as opposed to learning. And so in that respect, covering the Vermont State House, where the process was still kind of that pure idealistic setting, at least to some degree, definitely miss that. In other ways, it's very similar. I mean, the goal at covering the Vermont State House was, okay, you know, political nerd, I might be really fascinated by this discussion, but at the end of the day, you got to bring that story back to how the viewers are actually going to be impacted and what's going to matter in day-to-day lives.
Right, you're right, yeah. God, well, and that's no easy feat either.
I should add, well, the one other element I really miss about Vermont is it's a small state house. So if I needed to talk to a lawmaker, it was very hard for them to avoid me for a whole day. I could stake out the Senate chamber. I could stake out the House chamber to a lesser degree. I could stake out the governor's ceremonial office if I had to. Though there is a little back door at the back. When you're covering the Capitol, there are certain elements where you're not just allowed to show up with a camera and stick a microphone in someone's place. And there are pros and cons to that.
Yeah, right. To say nothing of the convenience of the cafeteria up there to kind of snag everybody who really was trying to avoid you. So that leads me into another question. You've been now in the field since roughly, 2010 or so, over 10 years. And those 10 years have been very, I want to say tumultuous. They feel like they've been tumultuous in terms of the journalism profession. Things have traveled a long way from the days when you as a reporter might go out to a meeting of some sort, make your notes, get a few interviews, get some quotes, race back to the newsroom, type up a story, or put it together on video. What stands out to you as what has changed over the past decade in terms of how the profession operates? Obviously, social media is now a gigantic element in all this, but is it vastly different, or is it basically the same thing, just with some new toys to play with?
It's hard to say, because in a way I've been that frog in the boiling water, getting hotter every minute or so, where you don't necessarily fully notice everything. I also would say that I've been lucky enough to find shops that are committed to old school journalism throughout my career. That was true in Montana. That was true at WCAX for sure. And it's been true here at our bureau. So we don't necessarily, I've never had to dive into search engine optimization, for instance, which for those of you who aren't in the industry basically amounts to figuring out how to be the top hit on Google. So luckily I've been able to avoid doing that. You know, social media is certainly a tool. It's not my favorite part of the job by any means. I'm also not the most entertaining follow, like some of my peers who do lean into that a little bit more heavily. But on the flip side of things, you also get a chance to hear more from the public than you necessarily used to. I mean, I certainly in my Montana newsroom, or in my Vermont newsroom at WCAX, you would get calls after stories aired. You would get emails after stories aired. But it wasn't the vast majority of the public. It tended to be the same characters time and time again. Now, certainly there were exceptions to that rule. Whereas, you know, with social media, you get a lot more feedback from the public. And some of it is social media nastiness. But there's also a good amount of good feedback that comes down, too. So I think that's strong. You know, certainly behind the scenes, the video editing software, from my perspective, can make a piece so much more dynamic without spending the amount of time that you would have had to in the past. It can clean up errors you make in the field from time to time, which is quite the relief. I had some audio that wasn't great the other day, and the computer with a little magic made it just about perfect. I don't think anyone could notice. So there are certainly pros and cons. I do think, you know, a greater interest in palace intrigue, which is, so to say, you know, the inner politics of the Biden administration or the Trump administration, has certainly dominated more and more the news cycle year over year over year. But that's a trend that started, you know, really with the rise of cable news. So I can't speak to the full arc of it, but it's certainly continuing.
Have you seen any big differences in how you cover Washington under the currently with the Biden administration now in office compared to the previous Trump administration? Is there any difference in kind of like approach or how people would respond to questions or anything like that?
Or, you know, I don't think I've got a good enough sample size with the Biden administration quite yet. And that's simply because the pandemic cropped up. So I have a White House press pass. I've been to the White House and the White House briefing room, you know, dozens of times. The Trump administration, I think, understood the importance of local news and regional media. So we could get major interviews with cabinet secretaries under the Trump administration. When we had questions, we would get answers or report that we weren't getting answers from them as was appropriate. With the Biden administration, we haven't had quite that same opportunity just yet, but I think that's more about the pandemic, because actually, speaking to your earlier question, one of the things I have noticed, and it was true, I'm told, because I wasn't here in DC quite yet under the Obama administration, and even more so under the Trump administration, and now certainly with the Biden administration, they've been showing it too. They understand that if you're going to go on cable news, you might get, you know, 1-2% of the nationwide television viewing audience. If you get on local news, especially if you want to talk about a subject that's particular to a region, you might get 30% of that TV news viewing audience that night. And so we saw it with the Biden administration with one of our stations in West Virginia. One of the first interviews that I believe it was Vice President Kamala Harris did was in West Virginia with one of our TV stations, kind of putting some political pressure on Senator Joe Manchin to get on board with some of these more liberal Democratic priorities that he's been obstructing to a degree.
Interesting. I was just thinking, since you were saying earlier that your beat runs from Maine to Kentucky or whatever, You might still get a chance to cover a few things out of Vermont. Is that the case, or no?
Absolutely, and I think some of my other stations might accuse me of having a slight favoritism for CAX. The communications a little bit more streamlined because I know still by heart most of the extensions in that newsroom if I have to get them in a pinch. But yes, it's certainly, we did a fair amount of coverage of Senator Bernie Sanders' latest presidential run. We talked to him a number of times earlier this spring. And even before, we talked to him after the Capitol riot. We talked to him about some prescription drug reform. We're hopefully lining up something soon to talk about budget reconciliation. So he's obviously a big figure for us, not only in my Vermont reporting, but in reporting that's of interest to our entire station group for obvious reasons. Senator Leahy, we will connect with when there's a good Vermont angle or where something comes up with the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was obviously someone we spoke to frequently during the confirmation process for Amy Coney Barrett, for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, to the Supreme Court. So when Vermont issues bubble up in the Capitol, especially when they're something that the national news media isn't going to be particularly interested, we try to make sure we fill that void for our viewers back home. And I do my best to keep up on Vermont state politics because it's still relevant to getting the job done down here.
I was just wondering, you know, one of the things that a lot of folks up here have been sort of feeling good about, and the governor is certainly, Governor Phil Scott has certainly taken the opportunity to remind us all fairly regularly, is the state is one of, I guess, still the highest vaccination rates during the pandemic era. Is that a fact or a factoid that kind of penetrates a bit down in Washington? Are people aware of that? And is it something that's mentioned every now and then when the subject of vaccination rates come up, like they did recently with the mandate that President Biden put out that businesses with over 100 employees should get their employees vaccinated?
You know, I think in the Washington bubble, Vermont does not gain a lot of attention, even when it comes to discussions of Senators Leahy and Sanders, who are obviously quite prominent, except there's a lot of expat Vermonters down here. And amongst that group, it certainly comes up all the time. I was in the newsroom doing a report on some federal opiate policy changes just last night. And in as we prepared for my segment, the photographer was listening into the rest of the newscast, and he heard the statistic that Vermont had 300 new cases in a day, that was a record, and it might even be a mistake in the data. That number might be higher than it actually is. And he said, holy cow, is that real? What is it that separates Vermont in this way? Because that's incredible. And I said, well, we like to think we're special, but I don't really know. So, you know, getting back to your question, certainly I've asked those questions of Dr. Fauci, of others that have been looking at COVID about what makes Vermont special, and they'll tout policy. They'll, you know, sometimes they'll lean into the talking points that Vermonters love to talk about how we're different and connected through our communities. But no, I don't think that most here have really fully wrapped their heads around what Vermont's been able to accomplish. And then there's the other element, and I covered this a bit when I did a piece on how Vermont's prisons were handling the COVID epidemic early on. And frankly, the data showed that they were doing a much better job in containing the spread. And in talking with some of the experts on this, they said, yeah, we're really impressed with what Vermont's done with its model, but we don't know that other states are necessarily in the position to replicate it, even if they tried, given some of the other challenges that they've faced that Vermont doesn't, whether it be from the prison infrastructure to a variety of, to just prison population numbers.
Mm. And finally, before we have to run here, I guess I was just wondering if you had any advice or suggestions to high school students back at Burn Burton or Arlington or any of the other high schools around here or anywhere about entering journalism. If there's a student that is thinking, you know, that seems like that'd be kind of interesting work. You get to meet all these people that you wouldn't probably meet any other way. And You get to have interesting conversations with people about different stuff all the time. But what suggestions or advice would you have for a student who's like in the 10th or 11th grade back here as to what the field is actually like?
Well, I'd say dive into whatever opportunity there is as soon as possible, because if you don't like it, you're not going to want to stick around for the pay. I'll be clear about that. I believe, Andrew, you might have been the first publication out of BBA News over when you were at the Journal that to ever put me in print. I covered a broadband hearing up over the mountain with Representative Patty Comline.
I remember that afterwards and thinking, this kid's got game. We ought to hire him. I mean, we need him now. And by the way, they're still talking about broadband in Londonderry and pretty much everywhere else. So you can refile that story if you wanted to.
Well, what you didn't see was me staying up till 3 a.m. listening to my less than quality recording of the meeting to try and get through the jargon and the weeds and make sure I actually understood it. Dive in, get that opportunity, whether with the Journal. I mean, Bill Mensch has done an incredible job restarting the BBA film and news program. That's certainly where I got the bug back under Brian Golic. When it came time for college, you know, I found a program that did a fair amount of journalism. There are some that don't let you touch a camera until junior year. That wouldn't be my recommendation. It works for some. Put yourself out there. Don't be scared to ask the dumb question. Don't be scared to reach out and say, hey, what can I do to get into this field? I was just talking to someone coming out of grad school the other day, and they were interested in coming down to DC. And my advice was, you know, find a shop where you can cover city council, find a shop where you can cover state politics. I promise you that generally speaking at most stations, there's not the entire newsroom is not beating down the news director's door to try to cover the city council beat. So, you know, if politics is the way you want to go, get in at that local level. And, if you are the type of person that constantly procrastinates, maybe journalism is for you. I need a deadline to function. It's one of the things that drew me to it. I like the stress. I like the pressure. That can be both a blessing and a curse at times. But find those opportunities. Reach out to me if you'd like. I'm happy to provide any individualized advice, and Andrew can put you in touch. But the only way to figure out if it's a good fit is to dive in.
Just do it, huh? Well, I agree with you. That all rings true to me for sure. It's certainly an interesting way to learn about your local town, because I've often felt that covering school boards, covering select boards, covering planning commission meetings, I mean, there's probably the same basic principles to that as there is to almost anything. And it's a great
Absolutely.
Way to
and you know, in D.C., compared to Vermont, it is harder to get these politicians off their talking points. They are a little bit more practiced in that. But if you take the right approach and you're actively listening, you can even get these folks to truly, you know, not so much focus on the black and white, but the gray area and the potential for wiggle room. And if you've done your homework, you know, this policy versus that policy. And that's when the conversations get really interesting. And even if some of those finer weeds don't necessarily make it into a minute and a half report, I like to paraphrase Mark Twain and say, the more I know, the more concise I can be. So even if some of those details don't necessarily make it, and it can guide you in making sure you focused on the right elements.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for now, Kyle. But once again, thank you very much for making the time for this conversation. Really, really appreciate that. And, just good to see you again, and maybe our paths will cross either here or there at some point down the road. But anyway, thank you very much for sharing all of that with us. And to our viewers, thank you for being with us today. Hope you found our discussion interesting, and we'll see you again the next time we do Press Pass in about 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.